I don't know about you, but it feels to me like it was a long time ago that I was last up a mountain. In fact, the last time I was up the mountain, I think, was in Romania in 2019. Sorry for faking. We were with Arthur and the Bakers there visiting the church in Romania. Even then, most of us cheated, to be honest, and rode to the top of the mountain in the cable car from Piatra Nant. Di is comforting Naomi, who was a little uncertain of the cable car at the time. Only Gary, I think, ran up the mountain, but, you know, that's Gary. I don't know about you, but for me, the last couple of years has felt more like a valley experience than a mountaintop experience. And we long for the mountaintop, don't we? Whether it's physically or whether it's just spiritually in our hearts, to be back on the mountaintop with the Lord. I'm reminded of Elijah in the Old Testament, seeing God defeat the prophets of Baal on the mountaintop as the fire descends on his altar. He's in a fantastic place, isn't he, seeing God at work in his life. However, even Elijah couldn't stay there, and in the next chapter we find him back in the valley. But God is still there, and God is still ministering to him, even in that valley experience. And that's our experience on this Christian journey that we're on. You know, there are the mountains and the valleys that we go through, but I have to admit, I do crave a bit of mountaintop. And to that end, we're going to journey with Jesus to the top of the mountain in Matthew 5. And hopefully we are going to experience that presence of God, that motivation of God. I was tempted to launch straight into the Beatitudes. That's the bit, you know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn. Well, we're going to unpack that in the coming weeks. It would be easy though to rush into that without giving frame of reference to where we are and what is going on here as Jesus goes up the mountain. So I want to give you a bit more of an overview this morning and place these words in their context. And when approaching any passage of the Bible, it's always good to ask the W questions. The questions that are what, where, when, why, who is talking. I know it sounds a bit like comprehension when you're doing English at school. I don't know if that was your favourite thing, not mine. But I do think that it's actually worth our time just to pause and to ask those questions. So let's start with the where. Where did these events take place? In simple terms, we're just told on a mountain. He went up on a mountain and sat down. If we were to go to chapter 8, we read of Jesus coming down from the mountain and entering the town of Capernaum. And if we look back to chapter 4 and verse 23, we read that Jesus in this period was teaching in the region of Galilee, around the lake of Galilee. And that's where much of his early ministry took place. Before he later on spent more time in Jerusalem. We find him going up to Jerusalem for various feasts, but he spends a lot of his time in this region of Galilee. So it's likely that the mountain Jesus climbed is this one known as Khan Hattin, or the Horns of Hattin. It's so named because two of the peaks resemble two horns. Apparently, I'm struggling to see it, but that's the case. And this mountain is found just 4 miles west of Galilee. It would be a relatively small mountain in mountain terms. About 4 miles west of Galilee, about 8 miles south of Capernaum. We don't know if this is the mountain for sure, but it does seem to make some logical sense. That's the where. Next comes the when. Well, it's, as I say, early in his public ministry. If we look at the progression of Matthew's gospel after Jesus is born, leading up to this time, it would seem that this sermon was preached somewhere near the outset of Jesus' public ministry. For around 30 years, Jesus bided his time, growing up in his parents' household, maturing physically from a boy into a man, perhaps helping out in his father's carpentry shop, if that's what we imagine. Although Joseph actually disappears from the Gospels, it's possible that Joseph died, we don't really know. But suddenly, at around the age of 30, Jesus is thrust into the limelight, into this new phase of life that begins when he's baptized by John in the River Jordan. Next follows Jesus' temptation by Satan in the wilderness. And then in chapter 4 and verse 17, we read how Jesus started to preach and to call his first disciples. And together with these newfound followers, he sets out on an extensive tour of this whole region around Galilee. If you can look closely at this map, you see different events and different things that happen all around the lake of Galilee. And this sensational ministry that Jesus has, the news of it begins to spread like wildfire across the whole region. And people start to travel from miles to hear Jesus. Was that their entire motive? Not always. Perhaps they'd heard that Jesus was healing people. And so lots of people were coming to him for healing, or bringing people to him for healing. And in a very short time, it's like Jesus assumed this celebrity status. If social media had been available at the time, Jesus would have been right at the top of the list of things that people were interested in. We've seen this week this thing, haven't we, of the aircraft flying in, and everybody's watching it. You know, everybody's watching the pilots trying to land in the wind at Heathrow. That's kind of top of the social media. Well, it would have been Jesus, okay? Jesus was such an amazing figure that he was the one that was trending in the charts, if you like, at the time. And we read in verse 25 of chapter 4, large crowds from Galilee, the Decapolis, that's the 10 major cities around the area, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. So he was attracting a crowd. Where? When? Who? Well, we've already answered this question to some extent. The who is Jesus. But who was he speaking to up the mountain? Because actually this isn't quite so obvious when you look into it. We read chapter 5 and verse 1. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him and he began to teach them. Did Jesus, on seeing how large the crowds were getting, flee up the mountain to kind of get away from them for a while? We certainly read it other times that he made space, didn't he? He took time alone to pray to God. At times he got in a boat and went out on Galilee to put some distance between himself and the crowds for a while. And why did he do that? Because although Jesus is God, he is also human. He takes on flesh and blood. And Jesus, like us, needs a break. He needs a rest. He needs time away from that direct ministry. So Jesus goes off up the mountain. And it appears he's joined by his disciples there. Was this just the chosen 12? Did he want a special time just alone with them to teach them? Was this group of disciples bigger than that? Was it 20 or 30 or whatever? It's not easy to discern. But it is quite important in the context of what he says in this sermon. We might be inclined to assume that the message on the mountain was just to a select few. However, if we turn to the end of the sermon and chapter 7 and verse 28, we read this. When Jesus had finished saying these things, finished his sermon, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as the teachers of the law. So right at the end of his sermon, there's crowds there again, okay? So it seems that people wouldn't leave him alone and that they followed him up the mountain. Have you ever been to one of those kind of historic buildings or a historic site, and as you enter, there's a guide giving the commentary? You know, the guide is there, and there's a group of tourists, they've paid, they're on their coach party or similar, and the talk is designed for them. But you find yourself kind of eavesdropping, listening in to what the guide is saying, because when you hear what the guide is saying, it starts to make so much more sense of what you're seeing, doesn't it? I find myself creeping closer and closer, just taking in the information. I kind of feel my wife squirming as I sort of sidelean on the tour, as it were. And I wonder if that's kind of what is happening here. That Jesus initially, you know, intends to spend some time with his disciples, but so many people have travelled to that region to hear Jesus, and they say, where's Jesus? Oh, he's gone up the mountain. Well, we better get ourselves up there. Up the mountain they go. And so by the end, he's gathered a crowd even up the mountain. The sermon actually starts, doesn't it, with the Beatitudes, which we'll be looking into, which are the virtues, the qualities that we should be living out if we claim to be Christians. The Beatitudes, someone said, are what our attitude should be. The Beatitudes, what your attitude should be. But the further the sermon goes on, and potentially the more the crowds start to grow on the mountain, listening to his teaching, the teaching actually becomes much more evangelistic later on. It talks about having treasures in heaven rather than treasures on earth. Ask, seek, and knock. And then you get the story of the wise and the foolish builders. This sermon is for those who had already come to faith in Jesus. It teaches how we should live out that Christian life and how we should manifest Jesus in our lives. But it's also for those weighing up the cost of the commitment of becoming a follower of Jesus. And that's good, isn't it? Because actually there will be people in this church today and in the coming weeks who are in all of those camps. There are those of us who've been Christians a long time, but we still have a lot to learn about what our attitude should be and how we should live. But there are other people who are weighing up whether even to be a follower of this Jesus. What is it about him that I should follow him? So I pray that God will open our ears and we will hear him and listen to what he says to us. We've looked at the where and the when and the who, but before we finally turn to the why, I just want to point out something here that we might miss if we're a little bit hasty. It's been a bit awkward of late having this bar stool to perch on with my dodgy knee. But you know, actually, it seems like I'm in good company. Because there in chapter 5, in verse 1, we read, Jesus sat down to preach. Good, isn't it? He sat down to preach. And if it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. Now, you might be thinking, I wish you would just go and sit down, but there we go. In our society, a teacher, a lecturer will usually stand to speak. We have a family wedding coming up in October, and it's traditional, isn't it, for the groom, the father of the bride, and the best man all to stand and to deliver a speech at the reception. But Jesus sits down. Sits down. Why? Was he just being different? Now, actually, this was the cultural normal. Jewish religious leaders were in those days in the habit of standing and walking round and pontificating and as they went about their way. But if they had something profound to say, if they had something official to say, they sat down. They sat down to deliver it. It was a kind of mark of it being important. And if you actually look in Matthew 23 and verse 1-3, Jesus says this. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. So you must be careful to do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. So they sit, as it were, in the position of the seat of Moses pontificating the important things. But actually, you need to weigh up everything you hear, and you need to weigh up everything you hear from me. So this was the common practice, to sit when giving important teaching, and that's exactly what Jesus does now. And some of this teaching is truly amazing. He sits down for what in our Bibles amounts to 3 chapters. You might think some of my sermons are long. I don't know how long it took him to get through those 3 chapters, but thankfully we're not doing it all in one day. In the words of Listening with Mother that I used to listen as a child, are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin. Well, actually, we won't begin, you'll be pleased to hear today. But before we close, we still need to ask why. Why did Jesus preach this sermon? And the answer, I think, is because of what were his priorities for being there. We need to consider what was happening with the crowds. People were flocking to Jesus. And for many of them, probably their priority was healing. This guy heals. Whatever our sickness, whatever our disease, we've got to come to him, or we've got to get our friends to him. But Jesus' priority, and Jesus' priority for all of us, is still our spiritual condition. Do you remember when those guys came with the paralytic and let him down through the roof? And you expect Jesus to say, be healed. But the first thing Jesus says to him is, your sins are forgiven. And then to prove that I have the power to forgive sins, get up, pick up your mat and walk. That the most important thing for that man who was paralyzed was to have his heart dealt with. Jesus is concerned about our practical needs, but primarily Jesus is concerned about our heart condition. There were plenty of people who wanted the benefit of association with Jesus. They liked that he could heal. They liked the idea of a free lunch. You know, when 5,000 turn up and he could provide them all lunch, they all turned up the next day and asked for another free lunch. There were lots of fringe benefits in being around Jesus. But Jesus understands that their greatest need is to teach them about following him. And that following him is not a soft option. Life as a follower of Jesus is not always a bed of roses. But actually, to become a Christian is a serious undertaking. It's exhausting, it's challenging, sometimes it's very tough. But it's worth every moment of the investment of our lives. And we need to be so careful when we preach the hope of Christianity. It's true that the gospel offers forgiveness from sin, hope for eternity, joy and peace at many levels. That there's the blessing of being part of a fantastic spiritual family such as we have here. But you need to know that there's a cost to commitment to Christ. And that's what the Beatitudes are all about. There needs to be genuine sorrow for sin. There are demands of humility and holiness that we'll explore in them. Many people like the idea of Jesus as a saviour, and that they can have a hope of heaven, but how many people want Jesus as Lord of their lives? To be truly in command of everything that they're doing. You know, I walked past the empty Debenhams store the other day. It's hard to believe it's gone, isn't it? It looks so vast and empty in there. I would often leave buying my clothes to their Blue Cross sale, so I do miss that. There were huge reductions to be had. A few years earlier, Woolworths went, didn't it? And I remember in Woolworths one particular counter, and it was this counter. My dad introduced me to Pick and Mix. It's his fault. I've had a sweet tooth ever since. But the Pick and Mix counter in Woolworths was fantastic. Why? Because you could just go in and pick the ones you liked, couldn't you? Even out of the box of roses or Quality Street, at Christmas you could just go in and, boy, I don't well like those red crackled ones. So let's just pick all the things that we like. But friends, we cannot do that with Christianity. We cannot just pick out the bits in the Bible that we like, that we feel comfortable with. Because Jesus in these Beatitudes is requiring of us, is looking to us, that there might be real change in our behaviour, in our attitudes. And those changes should accompany our claim to be Christians. If we claim to be saved, there should be works, there should be evidence that God is changing our lives to be more like Jesus. And these qualities are not found in us naturally. They're the fruit of the Spirit of God working us as we submit to his word, as we let it take effect in our lives, as we take seriously this challenge of being Christians. And I pray that God will help us as we consider what our attitude should be in the coming weeks. I hope to see you back up the mountain next week with Jesus. And I pray that he will lift us all to a new, joyful, exciting, thrilling experience of himself in the coming days. But if you're longing for the mountaintop, I have to tell you this, there is no cable car. There is no cable car, folks. It's about us grafting. We have to be prepared to climb to the top, to do a Gary. I'm not sure I'll be running up there. But we've got to exercise ourselves. We've got to get close to Christ. We've got to get close to his word. And the joy and the mountaintop experience will follow when we follow hard after him. God bless you.